I'm Alastair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
Hey everybody, welcome to this week's episode of Whiskey Neat, spirited conversations with interesting people. I am your host, Christopher Hart. Now I was thinking, we don't have the balconies out at the beginning, we need a some sort of something to segue into. So this week, I sit down, I gotta tell you, so let me just gush a little bit. A big part of why I do this show, one, is to drink and call it work. Two, is to meet some of my legitimate childhood heroes. Like, I never thought I would get to sit down with some people that I do get the chance to sit down with, and it's not because they're celebrity, it's because, like, Ike Barinholtz, I've been following Ike for 20 years. When I was in 8th grade, I saw Ike on Mad TV, and at the time I was obsessed with Mad TV, and we talk about it in the open, so I won't beat it to death, but this week I'm such a fan of Ike. I'm such a fan of his career, everything he's done. I'm not going to say my famous phrase for this, but I really am.
Do it.
I couldn't be a bigger fan. So this week I sit down with Ike Barinholtz. We talk about an upcoming movie he's in, which is so meta and so genius, called the, I got to get it right because it's such a unique name, The Unbearable Weightness of Talent. Is that what it is? The Unbearable Weight of Massive Talent. He's in a Nicolas Cage film that just where Nicolas Cage plays himself, an eccentric actor. And I was like, I've got to talk to Ike about this. So I reached out to his people. We do the show. We have a few drinks. I sent him a couple of great bottles. And we just talk about everything that he's accomplished. I'm such a fan. So this week I sit down with Ike Barinholtz. You know, he was in the Mindy Project. He has a great show called The After Party on Apple TV Plus right now. And is it Apple TV? I always confuse Paramount Plus. So Apple TV Plus, and okay, well, we got there. I gush over a childhood, I won't say childhood hero, but, you know, I was a fan for a long time. So let's get to paying the bills real quick. Just a quick update for those watching. Gregarious Grump, Prideful Goat, we're now in, God, we're on Sealbox. Please go to sealbox.com. Sealbox, SEELBACHS. If Brandon will add that into a title, that'd be great. Sealbox. All of our products are now available in all 50 states. Now, officially, they're only available in 20 states. But if you're in a state that Sealbox doesn't deliver to, and you buy something, and then you reach out to them and give them the FedEx label, they will send you your product. So they're technically available in all 50 states. And we're also in full distribution through, we just got to Kentucky, Colorado, Louisiana, Florida, California. I mean, things are really up, you know, they're moving for both Gregarious, Prideful Goat. I mean, things couldn't be better. So, without further ado, let's get to paying the bills real quick and then we'll jump into the interview. As I said this before, I've said this 1,000 times. If you're familiar with the concept of terroir and wine, you'll appreciate Mark Rainier's Waterford Single Malt Whiskey. Now, we no longer do brand interviews, but I'm actually going to sit down with Mark soon. I want to discuss his process. I want to talk about Waterford. Irish, I've said this for years, Irish and Canadian both have kind of floundered and have been a bulk disappointment until recently. The last couple of years, they're both going through a renaissance, higher proof offerings, single barrel offerings. In the case of Waterford, single farm, single origin, single grain offerings. They're really experimenting with what Irish single malt whiskey can do. So definitely go to glassrev.com, GLASS, glassrev, RAV.com/Waterford. Check it out. They've got all the information about your product, wherever you find it, wherever you buy it from. They've got the information on the terroir code on the bottle that can give you all, you know, what harvest it came from, what farm it came from. I mean, everything they're doing is pretty nerdy, and I like that. So without further ado, please welcome this week's guest, Ike Barinholtz. Cheers. here. Ike, welcome to the show, buddy.
My friend, how are you?
I'm good. I'm actually, the Thanos of Mad TV characters. I'm collecting them one at a time. I've had Brian Callen. I've had Ari Spears. Ike, buddy, I've been following you for literally since the beginning. I was such a Mad TV fan. So 20 years.
Nicole Sullivan and Jordan Peele, you can eliminate half of the universe.
That's about right. Yeah, I've got a few more I'd like to get on there. Will Sasso for sure, for one.
Oh my God. One of the funniest ever. Funniest human beings ever.
Well, just also one of the most wholesome, you know, straightforward, down to earth, silly goose time guy.
Oh,
you know?
My God. One of my favorites. Just saw him not too long ago. Are you mixing right now? What are you doing over there?
No, I jumped straight into something a little lighter. I think I sent you a few things. Did they all arrive?
I did. I'm at work right now, so I'm having like the world's best saddest, but it was wonderful. No, I got the whiskey you sent me in here.
So I think what we sent you, I think a couple different things. I'm starting with an Irish whiskey, something a little, you know, a little softer.
I got the bottle that's right in front of you. It's the rye, small batch rye.
This one?
Yeah. That's what I'm having right now. It's fantastic. I can only have a little bit because I have to run a writer's room after this, and I just don't want to like fall asleep.
No worries. No worries.
So I'm having just enough to wet my whistle and just get some of the taste, but it is beautiful. And you have an expensive kind of snifter, whereas I have the Dixie.
Yeah, you've got with the red beard and the fancy mustache and the plaid shirt, you've got to fit the hipster vibe. So I'm going with the expensive snifter.
Ooh, I got to say, it really is. Wait, can we give a shout out to that again? What is the rye you got?
It's the Prideful Goat. It's actually my product. I own it.
You own this? Hey,
yeah. Yeah. We just got distribution wonderful in California. I was there last week rolling it out to the market, kind of, you know, getting it out there. But yeah, it's got a nice punch in the throat. It's pretty high proof.
It's smooth going down, and then it hits you in the chest like 30 seconds later in a good way. Really nice. Congrats.
Thanks, man. So there's so much I want to talk to you about. One, I had to give the Mad TV shout out from the get go. Do you keep in contact with any of them still? I mean, you've done so much since then. It's hard to.
I saw Will Sasso last week. I text with Jordan Peele and Keegan, Nicole Parker. Nicole Sullivan is the godmother to my daughter. Whenever you see someone from Mad TV, there's just like that kinship, you know, fraternity, sorority. So I love those guys.
Do you, were you ever close with Bobby Lee? I mean, I kind of follow that podcasting realm.
Too close, I think. Too physically close in different parts of his body. Yeah, Bobby is like one of my favorite people ever. We have had crazy adventures before. I said to him, because I listened to his podcast, I said, I want to come on. He's like, he's asked me to come on, but he doesn't record until like 10 p.m. Bro, I'm like, if I'm not in bed by 9:30, like listening to like a Civil War podcast, like I'm in a bad mood. Like 10 o'clock is too, like I'm too tired at that point. Like my brain is like cooked from the day. So if I'm talking to someone at 10 o'clock, you're not going to get my best.
Yeah, he's a night owl. I know he plays video games till like 4 a.m. He sleeps in to like 2. I'm a big Bobby Lee fan as well. Obviously, I'm telling you, I love SNL, but the 90s for me growing up on Mad TV was like, God, you're always rooting for them over the SNL crowd, right? They got all the glamour.
Well, it's so funny. You know, I loved SNL like growing up. It was really one of my favorite shows. And, you know, I didn't really catch a ton of Mad TV when it first came out. I watched some of it. I loved In Living Color. And then I watched a couple of Mad TVs. I think Mad TV had that like a little bit of a moment. There was kind of that moment in like late 90s where SNL's cast was still kind of not like Will was there, but he wasn't like a star yet. And at that time, Mad had like really great people like Will Sasso and Alex Borstein, Nicole Sullivan, really, really, really just
killed it. Yeah.
People. But by the time I got to Mad, we also had really funny people, but SNL, I think the best SNL, whatever chunk is like I would say like 2000 to 2010 when I was really doing Mad TV, which that's when you had Will and Amy Poehler and Kristen Wiig and Rachel Dratch and Tina Fey and Fred Armisen. So by the time I got to Mad TV, SNL was really starting to like fire up again. So it was couldn't really hate them. You know, I'm sure there were some people mad. It was like, oh, SNL was bad this week, but I was like, man, that was pretty good. there's definitely some really funny things we did on that show. And I still wish it was still around. It'd be nice if it was still, we need more sketch comedy shows.
Yeah. I mean, your roots have spent a lot of time in the improvisation. Like I watched, cause again, it was such a big part of my childhood. I went back and looked up a few of your skits or sketches. And I saw you do an impersonation of Dane Cook that was just tremendous, tremendous, tremendous. And I wondered, one, did Dane ever reach out to you about, like, have you worked with him since? Has he brought that up? And two, have you ever dabbled in stand-up comic? Because I couldn't find any actual stand-up comedy from you.
I've done very little stand-up. I really kind of, starting in like 96, jumped into the improv world, and I just loved it. I loved the kind of just collaboration. I loved that there was very little prep, you know what I mean? And, you know, a lot of friends of mine did improv and then went into stand-up and then vice versa. I've probably done stand-up like 5 times in my life, and I really enjoy it. I really do. I think it's like very exhilarating. And when you get up there and you get laughs, it's a great feeling. It's just too much work. I'm just like, I write a lot and act, and I have kids, and just like the thought of like, also like, oh, I'm going on tour this week. It's just too much for me. So, but I did enjoy it. A lot of my friends are stand-ups. And as far as Dane, no, Dane was so big at the time. Like, he was like ever, especially in LA. I remember going to see him at this place, God, Irish pub over on Sunset Boulevard. And rock star, and Mad TV, our whole thing was just making fun of people, you know? And so, yeah, I did that impression, and people, I think, responded to it. I met him years later. He seemed very nice, but never worked with him. And I can't imagine he was chomping at the bit to work with me back then. So,
I mean, there was probably, I mean, do you know if he even saw it? Do you know? I mean, there's probably, oh, no.
I'm sure he saw it, because Bobby Lee, I feel like Bobby even told me he might have seen it, but this is like going back so long, I can't remember. But Bobby, you know, always was our stand-up guy. So whenever stuff was happening on Mad TV, the stand-up world would hear about it through Bobby. Stand-up world through Bobby. So I know Dane much. I feel like Bobby actually introduced me to Dane at like the Comedy Store. But it's just like, I like literally like anything past like a couple weeks ago, I'm like, I don't know. I don't remember anymore. But yeah, I would never worked with them.
Well, I mean, it's been a hectic 20 years. I mean, I guess you've been active since 2000, 2001. And you literally have not stopped working. And I went back and I rewatched The Oath, which, man, I got to tell you about that film. It is triggering from the family side of things, right? Like, I grew up in Southern Texas and up with a Pentecostal family. Everyone was extremely, leaned a certain way.
Yep.
And rewatching it even today, the anxiety translates to those watching it. The audience feels it. Are you still super? I know you've been big into politics. It's kind of consumed you a little bit at times. Since he left office, do you still feel that way, or are you a bit more chill nowadays?
I definitely not as much. It's one of those things where it was the whole process was just very disillusioning, I feel like, for a lot of people. I think a lot of people were like, the fact that this happened and now things are not much better. It's a very weird time. And you know, I made that movie just because it was all people were talking about, just at least in my orbit, like people were just all they wanted to talk about was politics. And I just wanted to make like a kind of a funny movie about the worst Thanksgiving. So I am very luckily not as attached to that. Like, I still read a little bit and I still get a little angry sometimes. And, you know, but it's one of those things where I think at that point, the concentration was so high that I was really just like,
and all my friends were too, you know, people just were just very wound up. And kind of since then, I try, a big part of it is not being on Twitter so much, I think is a very helpful thing.
Or Facebook. Yeah.
Or Facebook or Insta even, you know what I mean? Like I definitely have in the last couple of years been on social media as much, which is just like social media just gives you that instant information / dopamine rush, and it's addictive. And I tried to kind of try my best to live in the moment a little bit.
Well, you mentioned you have, let's give three kids, correct? I've got four, and I'm with you, man. The last, you know, working in the spirits industry, so much of the spirits industry is very left, and so much of my childhood's very right, that sure. A very innocuous post. Like I remember I posted, I just didn't like the new live action Mulan movie. And the first comment was, well, you wouldn't understand the cultural significance. And I'm like, okay, hold on. Like, and then the comment section would devolve into a political argument. So I've my wife and I, we had a whole conversation about it and just said, before you post anything, just try to think of something to post that's not going to be charged. And so my feed is basically booze and children. Yes. Children. You can't, there's nothing you can do there to read into it.
Yeah. It's really true. Someone said to me, like, social media is like, opening your window and yelling a crazy opinion. And then when someone's like, that's crazy, be like, you're crazy. You know, that's my opinion. And it's like, yeah, but you just yelled it at me. And I'm pretty much with you there. I'm kind of like, I'm just like, oh, I have a show I'd love for you to see. Here's how you can watch it. You know what I mean? Occasionally on Insta, I'm still like, ooh, look at this Manhattan I made. Really nice. You know what I mean? Like, or
look for at food. This. Yeah, look at this food. Meal I made.
Look at the steak I cooked. Just because that's just kind of like, that's the kind of stuff I like to look at when I'm online. So I like to give that out. But I was getting a little crazy, I think, too. Like during the last month, like I one night just posted a photo of, you know, Joe Biden. I was like, I'm voting for Joe Biden. And like the comments, just like thousands of
people. You silly fool.
I know. And I was just like, ever since then, I'm just kind of like, I don't, like, I'll talk to you about it, but it's tough to kind of persuade people. And who cares anyways? You know what I mean? Who cares? Like, figure it out. You know what I mean? Like, I think it's just a better use of my time if I'm just writing jokes where people shit their pants. And spend time with my kids and occasionally watch a basketball game. That just feels like a much healthier use of time. And then on the side, go and fight for the causes you believe in, donate, do it. But it just feels like if you're just putting it all out there online, you're just kind of at a certain point, you're courting arguments.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you're embracing the madness, and that's there literally is nothing. There's no way out of it.
There's no
doubt.
It's true.
One of the you talk about writing jokes about shitting yourself. Yeah. So you wrote Central Intelligence.
Yes. Yes.
And I'm a huge fan. It was a success. The Rock, Kevin Hart, awesome. But your endeavor into The Oath was both your directorial debut, as well as you wrote it and starred in it.
Yes.
Which has got to be difficult. I'd love to hear about how insanely difficult that was, if you have plans to avoid that in the future, or if it's just, yeah, you could definitely do it again without an issue.
You know, I knew it was, I had directed before, and I have a partner named Dave Stassen, who I work with on pretty much everything. And we initially wanted to direct when Mindy Kaling said to us, I want you guys to direct on our show, we said, okay, well, we'll direct as a team. And the DGA has pretty stringent rules about teams of directors. They're very tight on it. I think like the Coen brothers for a long time were not allowed to like direct together. They're brothers. So we were directing on our own. So once I kind of directed on my own, I was like, okay, well, I have this idea. I want to direct a movie, and I want to direct this like really just horrifying Thanksgiving comedy. And so, you know, it, in a way it because it's all on you, it's faster. It's a little more accelerated because I'm just like, I wrote it here, get a little feedback, rewriting it. Okay. Let's, you know, as opposed to normally where you're like, we wrote this draft, we're going to send it to the studio who is going to then probably bring in another writer to do a pass on it. And then maybe we'll look at it again. And the director will do his pass. So many different people in the process that it inevitably takes a really long time. But for when you're doing it on your own and it's a super low budget movie, you're able to kind of move very fast, which is really great. It's like the whole thing happened for me bringing the idea to Sean McKittrick and Ray Mansfield and like finishing it was like 7 months. You know what I mean? It was just a very hyper accelerated process. I loved it. It was great. Definitely we'll do it again. You know, right now we're working on a show and running a show. And it's one of those things where directing on top of that would be a little too much work right now. But I loved that feeling of making like a movie. It really feels like you're on like a submarine a little bit. And, you know, you only have whatever, 41 days. That movie will be shot in like 20. But like for a normal movie, you have like, you know, a month or so and you have your people and you're all diving together and it's very exhilarating. And yeah, definitely we'll do that again.
What you've written a lot of things. And I wondered this when I looked at the just kind of looking at stuff you've either written in or written and starred in. Or written but didn't direct, like in Central Intelligence. Has there ever been a time in which you wrote something and maybe the director or at some point in the process, they were not understanding what you were intending, they were doing it wrong, or they were executing your vision wrong? And how does that work? Do they get to trump you or you get to trump them and say, no, that's not what I meant? Does that make sense?
Yes, definitely makes sense. You pretty much get trumped throughout until you get to the point where you're either the director or the showrunner, you know, and I kind of like over the years, we've had people come in and rewrite us and we've delivered drafts and the new writers have come in. And I think back now about like how mad I would get, like, can you believe they changed that joke? How does it work if it's a yellow Volkswagen? It doesn't make sense. And it's like, you're super passionate about it. And then like you look back years later and you're like, oh, they could have, they were maybe right about that. You know what I mean? Or it doesn't matter. And I, somewhere along the way, I think I have learned
to let go,
to not be too precious. And, you know, you're working on a show and if you're the sole person who's making the decisions, whatever you want to do, you're going to do you, then you're trumping everyone. But like in a show like we're working on now, there's like a bunch of different people that have to kind of agree on stuff. So you pick your battles, you pick the things you really care about and you kind of, you know, lobby for that. And then the other stuff, if you really don't really care about it, then I just kind of like, oh yeah, it's fine. You know, I'll voice my opinion and I'll try to make it as good as it can. But at the end of the day, it's like, I'm not going to fight over it.
Yeah, I think I'm with you up until the point that it may be something that ruins the film.
Oh yeah, but also even then, like even if like you don't have the power to change it, like what are you gonna do? Are you gonna like publicly like I taking my name off this movie? You know what I mean? It's like you just kind of have to be like, yeah, I really don't think, you know. I luckily have not been in that situation where I've like, hey, this is not going to work. Don't do it, and they're like, you don't know what you're talking about. I think that, yeah, they're ultimately, unless you make the call, they're going to do what they want to do. So try to make it as good as it can be.
In one of your previous interviews, you've talked about how you grew up in a pretty rough part of Chicago at times and had friends that were actually killed. Yeah. How do you go from such a rough upbringing to being, I mean, I can't help but look at you on camera, think of everything I've seen you in, and it all be comedic, smiling silliness.
Well, you know, first of all, just so I don't paint myself in like I grew up in Cabrini Green, I grew up in Uptown, which like my neighbor got shot in front of our house. You know what I mean? It wasn't like a great neighborhood. Definitely had lost a couple of friends when I was younger. But I really think that for the most part, I've been very lucky. You know what I mean? Despite the fact that we didn't have a ton of money growing up and yeah, a couple really shitty things happened. I feel like, you know, I'm lucky to be who I am. And more importantly, when I was, I don't know how old you are, but
34.
You're 80s
baby.
You're an 80s baby. It's a little similar for us. You know, I think people who were raised in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, I think, really got the best of America. They got the best time where things were relative. I mean, I know crime was up, but like, it was a very good time to
grow. Like, this is leading towards a Make America Great Again speech. Is that what you're...
All I'm saying is if you go to my website, there's a donate button and it goes right to 2024. And it's going to be very different this time. But I think we just grew up in a good time where we were afforded, you know... I don't know. Life was just easier back then. I think it's hard now. I think it's really hard. I think it's tough. You know, I know people, we complain about younger generations, but it's hard for them. Like, we didn't have the internet, you know? Yeah. So we couldn't, you know, look stuff up, but also you weren't like bullied online and you weren't, you know, worried about like getting shot all the time. and you didn't have the kind of reality of climate change hitting you in the face. So I feel like people who grew up a while ago had it a little bit easier.
It was simpler.
So even though some bad things happened, I you know, was just very lucky to kind of have my folks who are very funny people. My brother's one of the funniest guys on this planet. All my friends were just like funny. We all like we all watched movies back and we all watched the same stuff, right? So like we could talk about, oh my God, Eddie Murphy was so funny. Oh, did you see, you know, Fletch? You know what I mean? And it's so different now. Everyone watches different stuff and it's just so separate. So I really think it's, you know, even though, yeah, some yucky things happened growing up when I did, as I did, just being a white guy, you know what I mean? In Chicago in the mid 80s, it's not bad.
Yeah. My daughters, they're so wholesome and like, you know, they're 16 and 17 right now. And my daughter, they've been obsessed. That's right. They have social media right now. And they see themselves constantly being compared to other things. They're obsessed with this long fingernails, right? Like that when we go get daddy daughter days and we go get mani pedis together, I'll get it to pedi. I avoid the mani, but I'll get a mani pedi with my daughters and they'll leave with 3-inch long fingernails. And I tell them like this, you realize like when you go for a job or something like that, that's not usually the real world. The real world is mostly pretty subdued. What you're really seeing
normal
is
normal people. Yeah.
It's social media. Yeah. And so my daughter had her first job interview and the very first thing they said, no other part. She just looks like a normal, you know, there's no assumptions being made on anything other than the fact that her nails are 3-inch long, 3 inches long. And they're like, yeah, you're hired, but we need you to cut those in half. Right. Like just something a bit more moderate. And I think it's, the view to me, it looks ridiculous, but to them, their only perception of the world is what they see on social media. So it isn't, it's an odd time right now. And I agree with you completely. It was so much more simpler back then. Right. If I wore skates, I was never mind. You get bullied. Like it was very simple.
But also when you get bullied, you know, a lot of times that bullying kind of dies. You know what I mean? Like it doesn't live on social media as much.
Right.
Like,
less there's no evidence of it.
There's no evidence of it. Like, yeah. So I my heart like goes out to these kids now because they have to deal with a lot more bullshit than we did. But at the same time, we're still a good generation. We're still very cool, I think. We're not lame. We're cool. We have good stuff.
So you've got a movie coming out soon. I saw one interview you did about it, but it was very, very, there wasn't a lot of detail to it. I want to know how it was like working with Nicolas Cage in this upcoming film.
The unbearable weight of massive talent, my friend.
What a meta and perfectly fantastic. Like he was like, yeah, that's a great idea. Let's do this. I mean, it's so self-deprecating and so genius. And so I'm so excited.
Every once in a while you hear about a movie that goes up where as a writer, I'm just like, damn it. Because you'll spend days thinking of like, what is that golden goose? And
this has Tom, to be it.
Tom Gormican got the golden goose, right? Which is he wrote a script good enough to get Nick Cage to play himself. Which is something that just we've wanted to see forever. And he got it. And so, yeah, I had heard about it and had talked to Tom about it for a while. And, you know, for me, when he called to see if I wanted to do it, it was a very easy yes. I love Nick Cage. I've been a fan of his since I saw Peggy Sue Got Married in 1985. And, I also kind of, the part is a little bit like this, the kind of hardened CIA.
Your part?
Yeah. Station agent who's kind of really
a jerk,
kind of a hard ass jerk.
Suicide Squad style.
Not as bad as Suicide Squad style. I always like whenever I would watch the Bourne movies, I would always be like, oh man, you know what part would be great is Chris Cooper or Joan Allen or David Strathern. One of the people in the room who's like, that's Jason Bourne. Get him. Move to Alexander Platz. He's moving now. Like that whole vibe is very interesting to me. So when I kind of saw that that's a little bit what this was, and then it's like with Nick and Tiffany, I was just like, oh yeah, let's... Yes, let's do this.
She's one of my great white buffaloes I'd love to sit down and talk with, because her journey is great. She's also completely personable. Everything about her energy is like you're rooting at every step of the way, like rooting for Tiffany Haddish.
Everyone loves her, man. She's everyone's favorite. She's just like, I first like remember seeing her in Girls Trip. And I was like, oh my God, she's like a ray of like from the Lord. He sent us down for her. And so then I was like, oh, I was getting ready to make the oath. I think I had, oh no. I take it back. I saw her in Keanu and I was like, I want her to play my wife one day. And so I started writing the oath. And I was like, I had Tiffany in my mind. Then I saw Girls Trip. I was like, okay, she's like the greatest thing ever. So we had this long like hang. She came to the Mindy Project set and we hung out. And I was like, it's so good to meet you. She's like, we were in Meet the Spartans together. You don't remember that, huh? Yeah, me. She's the best, man. She's just her and I. So, this is like the fourth thing we've done together. I just love her.
So that's how it works. I guess you have your people reach out, or you reach out and just say, hey, do you want to come by the Mindy Project, see like how our vibe is and if we want to work together?
Yeah. I mean, I sent her the script and I sent her a, you know, note and just said, hey, I just wrote this part for you. And I'm just such a huge fan and would love to talk. And she slept all the way over to Universal and came and we sat and she was like, yeah, I want to do it and we'll make it work. So it was just very, I think she just liked the script and trusted me a little bit after that. And now we've done like, yeah, five things together. I think it's crazy.
Yeah. We've worked together a lot. Yeah. What, have you, I mean, I know you've done so much in the past 20 years. Is there a realm? I mean, you've covered dabbled a little bit in the superhero genre.
Yeah.
But not fully, you know, as you are, meaning I don't think you've been a superhero other than, I think you did some voiceover work, right?
I did. I was Muscle Man in the Awesomes on Hulu. And then I just actually last year, we did this really great Batman, audio podcast thing. That's actually got turned into a comic book and I got to play Two-Face. It was always kind of one of my low.
Yeah. Harvey did. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I meant. Like you've done some of the audio stuff. Is there two things? Is there ever any hope? Do you find yourself only working silly? Is there hopes to do a specific genre you haven't covered yet in terms of writing and directing, or do you have hopes to potentially play? You know, who was Flula? Was so funny as
Flula.
Yeah,
we were just talking about Flula. Flula is very funny. You know, I don't know. I there's a lot of superhero stuff out there. I just want to do good stuff. I know that's kind of a boring answer. right now we're doing History of the World Part 2 with Mel Brooks, which is kind of something that I've just
insane
lifelong dream.
What an honor. Yeah.
Crazy, crazy, crazy. And kind of doing that is just like a big box check off, like doing like a big crazy genre epic thing that's historical bend. I've always kind of wanted to do something like that, like play a cowboy and whatnot. So that's like one. And you know, I to me, it's like I would do anything if it's good. You know what I mean? Like I love when I get sent stuff that's like a weird little drama and it's a weird part. Usually I can't do it, but I love kind of stepping out of my comfort zone a little bit. But it just kind of seems like, you know, right now at this moment, all I can think of is History of the World Part 2, because like we're literally in the middle of shooting it right now. This is like our hiatus day. But yeah, no, there's other stuff. How about this? Ready? Everyone's talking about James Bond. Has there ever been a James Bond from Chicago? No. And I think this would really piss a lot of people off. If it's like they went with a guy he's in not great shape. He doesn't even drink gin.
The people's Bond. Yeah.
Yeah. The people's Bond, a Bond that doesn't make regular guys that watch Bond feel like a schlub. You know what I mean? Like you look up there, you look at Idris Elba or like it's Tom Hardy. It'll probably be Tom Hardy, I guess.
It'll probably be Tom Hardy for sure.
It'll probably be Tom Hardy. Bond, James Bond. That's how he'll say it. Denise Bond, James Bond. That's imagine how he would say it. I have a vodka martini shake in the stud. That's how he acts in Venom. Great actor. Tough to understand. But I think if I got cast as Bond, I think that would be really splashy. And I think the Broccoli family, if they want to get serious about keeping the franchise going, can pass on Tom Hardy and come to Barinholtz country.
So you, going back to the unbearable weight of massive talent. Yes. So I know you told the story about the first time you met him and you told him that you saw him in, what was that movie you just mentioned from 85?
Peggy Sue Got Married. Francis Ford Coppola.
Got Married. Yeah. Did you share a drink at all after that? Did you guys have you spent any time together?
I haven't. I'm gonna see him. I think Monday night they're having like a screening for the movie out here, so I'm looking forward to kind of seeing him. I haven't seen him since that day, but we really had a lot of fun together. It's crazy. One minute you're like looking at Nicolas Cage and you're like, oh my god, that's H.I. McDonough from Raising Arizona. And then like 20 minutes later, you're improvising together and he's like, oh, that's good. That's good. Oh, what about this? What about this? Yeah, I would love to have a drink with him. I would like to go to, I would like to go to Las Vegas with him for 2 days and just never leave
and die. Yeah. You'll probably die. Just
slowly succumb.
Yeah. I was in New Orleans for the first time a couple of years ago. And I've heard so much about the city being so iconic and so old, and the Uber driver drove past this mansion and she was like, that house was bought by Nicolas Cage in like 2012 or something. And it was some house, which I found out later was part of like, it was like a really, that house is like cursed. It has like this nefarious history.
Awesome.
This woman used to keep and then kill slaves in the attic. It was a whole thing. And he bought the house, and then since then the key believes that house is cursed. And I've always just been, I just want to have a drink and a conversation and with this. He's so iconic in every regard, and I was such a Superman fan growing up, still am. Like there's so much what you want to talk about with who that guy is. Plus there's so much to talk about, like every iconic film he's been in and crazy story you've heard. And I can't imagine it was a boring day on set.
No, man, it was because it is. He's been around for so long. I did this like a little junkety thing the other day, and they did, how many Nicolas Cage movies can you name in 60 seconds? And I busted out about 30. Yeah. And I forgot about 30. And it's just like, geez, he's just been doing it for so long. There's so many chunks of his career where I can instantly, like an almost Proustian way, remember where I was when my dad first brought home the VHS of Raising Arizona. I remember where I was when I saw The Rock at the Esquire Theater in Chicago.
Con Air. I remember Con Air. There's a few.
I remember moving to LA and watching Adaptation and being like, I'm in this business. Like, it was like, he's just kind of been that, like, you know, North Star for all of us just because he's been around so long.
I remember watching Gone in 60 Seconds at a sleepover at my church's friend, my youth group, a friend's house. I can't even talk today. I went to a friend's house from my youth group and we watched Gone in 60 Seconds. It was one of the most incredible, like, you remember these moments in your childhood. Yeah. And, you know, even much later, I mean, when I saw that, I had no kids. Now I have adults. Yes.
And the crazy thing is now my kids, like, they know him as the Grok on the Croods. You know what I mean? Like, said, like, he's just one of those guys who's been with us for so long that he's now into the next generation. Our kids know who
he is. It's four decades, right? 80s, 90s, four decades of a career.
Four decades. Wild. Really. And, like, still, like, comes on set, like, first guy there, knows his lines, your lines, the stage direction, like, just been, it's like when you play basketball with, like, someone who's been playing it for years. Like, I remember one time I played a pickup game with Mark Aguirre, and, like, he had been out of the league for at least 3 years, but he's just like, it's just ridiculous. Like, it's a different thing. It's just, yeah, it's amazing.
Well, you've been in this for two decades now and have been doing it so long that you've got to have a lot of those stories. I mean, I think I remember you telling a story about meeting Chris Farley for the first time and giving him a ride to a party. Like, it's when do you become numb to all this? Have you gotten numb yet? Or does this still feel, you still get awestruck?
I still get awestruck. Yeah. You know, actors too. I met Dave Winfield the other day. I was like, oh my God, Dave Winfield. You know what I mean? But yeah, no, I still get a little goosed sometimes when there's someone who, you know, and it's not like the biggest Watt star, right? Where you're like, oh my God, there's whatever. I don't know, Kim Kardashian. Like, I met Jason Alexander the other day.
Oh my God.
I was just like losing my mind. I was like,
oh, super smart guy. Yeah.
So funny, so great. Like, it turns out we live near each other, and just like, so yeah, it's very, I'm constantly tickled at these little moments you have where someone who you've been a fan of your whole life watching for a long time before you know what you're talking about. It's crazy, crazy thing about living in LA.
I'm not sure how old your kids are. Do they have, do you want them to watch your stuff or like where?
Oh yeah, where? My kids watch. I mean, it depends. Like, I'm not going to let them watch something that's like hard R. But I just did the After Party.
Is there something that you've done that has the hard R in it? I don't recall.
Oh, like, I wouldn't let them watch. I would not let them right now watch Blockers.
Sure.
Or Neighbors. You know what I mean? Like, that when they're 14, 13, sure. But they're still like all under 10. But like, I let them watch the After Party. The After Party's got maybe like an F-bomb or two.
Sure. It's fantastic, by the way. It's fantastic.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, no, it's fun. And it's like also like fun, you know, mystery. So kids like it. The older daughter, though, we're just shitty parents. We let her like last summer just because we didn't want to like argue. Let her watch Mayor of Easttown with us, which was a bad idea. It's a very dark show. But yeah, it's nice for the kids sometimes to be able to see some things you could do just because there's some things that they can't, and you don't want them to not see anything. Like, I have some friends that are in the business that, like, the kids, they'll never know. And I'm like, they're going to find out one way or the other. One day a kid is going to be like, oh, I saw your dad in a movie. I saw his butt. So get ahead of it is what I tell people.
Right. Yeah. One of the things that we, growing up with such a controlling environment, you know, such a religious, we weren't allowed to go to the movie theaters. Right. Like, it was a big part of our religion is like, that's a dark place. You don't, you know, wait for it to come home. Your parents could screen it. We've taken the opposite approach. We want our kids to kind of be exposed to what they might normally see in life and not overly dictate what, you know, I think our kids are smart enough to know you can't go to school and say shit.
Yeah. You know? Yes. Oh, absolutely. And like when my daughter, older daughter, you explain to her, like when she, maybe I'm listening to a podcast or someone drops an F-bomb or something, or we're watching like a movie and someone says it, she kind of make a face, but then she'll say like, it's okay. I know not to say that. You know what I mean? It's like, if you teach them, it's like, if you hide it from them, once they find it, they're going to use it. But if you're open with them, you explain to them why it's wrong, I think you have a much better shot at not having your kid, you know, call his teacher an effing idiot.
Yeah, we I had this great conversation with William H. Macy about this, about having this approach to your children's lives to give them room to be themselves without overly trying to control them. Because I realize that my daughters, if they go somewhere, they're going to say what they're going to cuss in front of their friends. If they're going to cuss in front of their friends, there's nothing I can do to stop them of that. But you know, just don't do it in front of us. Don't do it on camera, and don't do it in front of other parents.
Yep.
And that applies to everything.
That's the universal rule for all things, guys.
Yeah. Nothing on camera, nothing in front of other people. You, in this current environment, you just have to make sure that, you know, you give them room to be themselves and not, you know, and I think they're better off for it. You know, so far we'll see. You only get one shot though, right? Like,
get one shot and there's no take backs and you're stuck with them. So yeah, you just got to hope you're doing the right thing. And we'll make mistakes. We'll make lots of mistakes, but we'll be fine.
What, the after party, man, I hate to do these interviews where all I do is shower these people with affection.
I love when you do these interviews,
but
I like being showered and bathed.
Bathed. Yeah. No, it's so good. I started watching with my wife and then, we stopped after the first episode and then watched the interview where you talked about how each episode is from the perspective of the person.
Yeah.
And so you being such a total douchebag was like,
yeah,
it was so natural and so great. And that scene with you and Dave Franco is easily one of the funniest things. I haven't finished the season yet. So I've only watched the first three episodes.
Got it.
It's incredible. And for those who don't know, it's essentially a murder mystery. And people are, I mean, I'll tell you what, you tell those listening.
I'll
what.
Tell you.
Yeah.
So The After Party, which is now streaming on Apple TV Plus, it is a high school reunion murder mystery. And each episode is told from the point of view of one of the suspects. And each of those suspects has their own kind of a genre that they're doing. So for instance, Sam Richardson's kind of in love with Zoe. So his story is like a rom-com, right? It's shot like a rom-com, music like a rom-com. My character is kind of a sadder middle-aged guy. So he loves like Fast and Furious and Steven Seagal movies. So he's kind of envisioned himself in this as the star of this action movie. So we hit them all. We have a musical, we have a thriller, we have a cartoon, and it's created by Chris Miller, who of Lord and Miller, who created 21 Jump Street, the Lego movie. And it's, I will say, it's sometimes you make things and you see them and you're like, I had a good time making.
Yeah.
And there's times where you make things, you're like, I had a good time making that and I love it. And I can wholeheartedly tell people, hey, watch this movie, watch this show. And what Chris did with The After Party definitely falls in that latter category.
It's absolutely fantastic. So one last suggestion and then I'll let you go. I'd love to see you touch a horror comedy.
Oh man, we kind of are talking about something like that right now. It's funny, during COVID, we started kind of working on something that was like that thriller slashery comedy. And then a couple other things kind of just got in there, but it's kind of just sitting there and definitely feels like I don't love straight horror. Like I when it's good, but like, I really like more of like the Get Out vibe, where you got some laughs and you also have some scares and but that's a world that I really enjoy watching and definitely would want to jump into.
To be clear, as much as I love scary movie, not that, right? Like not
scary
like,
movie
like an no. act more Jordan Peele-ish, right? More
yes, you want something that like, yeah, that just really Yeah.
Not a farce, but something a bit more intense.
We're doing like enough kind of, you know, farce and crazy stuff with history of the world right now. After this, we'll probably do something nice and spooky.
What's the, is History World going to be a series, you said?
Yeah, it's a series. It's going to be 8 episodes for Hulu, hopefully coming out, who knows, but we're shooting it right now in LA, and it's all I can say is it's epic. It is truly the biggest thing we've ever done, and we're really, really, really excited to wrap it up and show people.
Well, Ike, I can't thank you enough. I mean this when I say this. This is a, for someone who's been a fan of yours since I was literally in 8th grade.
Oh my God.
It's an honor to get the chance to spend an hour with you and just talk. And I know that seems ridiculous because I look 40, but it's the alcohol.
You look 40 and I feel 70. So I think we're a good match, my friend. Thank you so much for having me on, man. Let's definitely do it again. I really, really appreciate it.
Well, I appreciate it, buddy. Cheers.
Cheers, Ted. Thank you for the booze. I only got to have a tiny little sip because I'm at work, but Friday night, that thing is going to be put into a world-class Boulevardier.
It sounds good, buddy. Cheers.
Take care, guys. See you.
I'm Alistair Campbell from The Rest Is Politics.
Nish Kumar here from Pod Save the UK.
And Christiana Figueres from Outrage and Optimism.
Rising inequality, conflict, climate disaster, it's very hard to find reasons to be hopeful about the future.
That's why we're teaming up this September during the 80th General Assembly of the United Nations.
Along with Political Currency, Pod Save the World, The Week Junior, and more.
We'll discuss the stories that give us hope and answer the question, how does hope turn into action?
Look out for the Be Hope Takeover this September.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hey, wake up. New drinks just dropped at Wendy's. Cold foam, cold brew coffee, and sparkling energy. Both the caramel and the chocolate cold foam are just, so good. And the pineapple citrus and cherry limeade sparkling energy each have
80 to 120 milligrams
of added caffeine. So whether you need a treat first thing or to just stop yawning already, mornings hit different. To pick up a new pick-me-up, gotta be Wendy's. At participating U.S. Wendy's,